or that sets a criteria that lets a person know what's required of him in order to make parole, rather than being set off 3 and 5 years based on the feelings of a parole board that never ever sees you.
I want to make very clear, we are speaking to Kinetic Justice in solitary confinement at Holman in Alabama, one of the most overcrowded prisons in the country. How did you wind up in solitary confinement, Kinetic?
In January of 2014, in response to inhumane treatment and unsanitary living conditions, as well as the lack of educational rehabilitation, me and a couple of my comrades came together and put together what is called the Free Alabama Movement, which is a movement for the freedom, justice, and equality of the over 30,000 people incarcerated in the state of Alabama. In January of 2014, at Holman, we began a coordinated work strike that spread to three other institutions. And as a result of that, I was labeled as the leader and targeted as the leader of the Free Alabama Movement and declared a threat to the security of the Alabama Department of Corrections and placed in solitary confinement indefinitely.
We're going to have to break to end the show, but we're going to continue with you as well as Pastor Kenneth Glasgow, founder and national president of the Ordinary People's Society, a faith-based organization. We're going to speak to him in Montgomery outside of the bars. So we'll post that online at democracynow.org. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Kinetic Justice. Please stay on the line if you can. Kinetic Justice is co-founder of Free Alabama Movement, currently serving his 28th month, more than 2 years in solitary confinement at William C. Holman Correctional Facility in Alabama, speaking to us from solitary confinement in prison. That does it for our broadcast. We have job openings in our video news production.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:01. Next up, Positively Revolting Talk Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by a KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Oregon Zoo Summer Concerts, presenting Case, Lang, and Veers, an evening of music with songwriters Nico Case, Katie Lang, and Laura Veers, Saturday, July 2nd at the Oregon Zoo. Tickets and information for Case Lang Veers at the zoo on July 2nd are available at zooconcerts.com.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
Comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
Good morning. Good morning. It is 8:03 in the a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Lynn.
And I'm Ani.
And we are here being positively revolting, as we do most Fridays,
together
at this time of the morning. This morning, we are really pleased to once again, we hardly ever have a two-part thing, and this has been very nice because it's hard to get all the things with Michael in 1 hour. So he was very kindly given us 2 hours of his time. He's Michael Mead is a renowned storyteller, author, scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology, who combines storytelling, street savvy, because he's a guy from New York, perceptiveness, and spellbinding interpretations of ancient myths. Plus, I think we're going to get into that. There are some new things coming up, and he has this knowledge of cross-cultural rituals and uses it when he speaks and writes and synthesizes all these disciplines, which kind of taps into ancestral sources and wisdom and makes them relevant to what is going on with us humans today. He's the author of many books, Fate and Destiny, The Two Agreements of the Soul, Why the World Doesn't End, The Water of Life, to name a few. But we're here to discuss his new book, The Genius Myth. Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Michael Mead.
Oh, there
Hi,
we
there
go.
You are. Yay, yay, yay.
Oh, I'm there. Good morning.
Good morning, good morning. I know.
It's I early. Like it when the magic works.
So, good morning, Michael. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you.
Very good. Glad to hear that. Well, so your road trip is entitled The Churning Times, which is extremely appropriate. And churning is generally, apparently, what we humans need to move the stagnant status quo. And you know, it can be painful and dangerous. And I wish that we humans could just sort of move elegantly and gracefully from one stage of history to another, but doesn't seem to be apparently how we can do it. And the central story that we've had in Western culture for a long time is the myth of the hero. And it's pretty, in your book, you talk about how kind of patriarchal, and there's always, you know, conquering going on with that and some violent things. And you talk about, suggest anyway, that a more tender and let's say less gender identified mythology that could be, because folks need stories. We need stories more than facts, that's for sure, to change, and that the genius myth could serve us better, shall we say.
Yeah, I took the old idea of the tough-minded and the tender-minded. And so the notion is that throughout human history, we've needed these two approaches to survive. In other words, a person has to be tough at times. It's a famine. You know, people have to figure out how to survive the famine. It can take tough-mindedness and so on. But then there's the tender-minded that is one of the terms for it. So that's the person who's more open to vision, more tuned to imagination. And that person is necessary for survival. They're not just the artist and the strange people out on the fringe. They're the ones imagining the future. They're the ones actually sometimes more fully present in the present. And in the extreme, the tough-minded become the hard-hearted and the hard-headed, so that when you see polarization the way it's happening in contemporary political life, the tough-minded is the far right, where things get just hard-hearted, ideological, hard-minded, and decisions are made. And one of the troubles with a hard-headed ideology is you can make very inhuman decisions that cause a lot of harm and feel justified. So in the extreme, the hard-headed, or the hard-minded, the tough-minded, call it what you will, becomes very dismissive of the pain of people and also loses all connection to nature and the great visions of human imagination. The tender-minded, they have their own troubles too. They can become flighty, out of touch with the reality, and kind of even lose touch with their own self. But when it's working properly, the tender-minded are able to be compassionate and empathic and visionary. They're in touch with dreams, and they're in touch with the way of surviving disaster that is inclusive of people. So then I took the idea of the hero, which can tend to be, you know, overly heroic and powerful, tends to be masculine, tends to have, you know, that kind of gender identification and the lack of the tender identification. And I thought it might be opposed to the old idea of genius. Not everybody can be a hero, but everybody is born with some genius qualities. And so in what I'm calling the genius myth, everyone, regardless of orientation, regardless of where they come from or where they fit into things, has some capacity for genius that could contribute to everybody or more people surviving all the disasters that we seem to have to live through now.
Yeah, it seems much more inclusive. Sometimes when I think of heroes, I think of them on a pedestal somewhere, in stone almost. I mean, and then when I really got burned out on the hero myth was after 9/11, there was just way too much talk about heroes and not enough about people. So I like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and heroes did used to be elevated and put in stone. Even that's misunderstood. The hero wasn't necessarily the strong person. The origin of it is deeper than the modern understanding of it. The heroic person was the person through whom, like, divine energy moved. And that could make them a great athlete or make them an orator or something like that. And so when they were elevated and put in stone, it was kind of a reminder, in a sense, that something moves through us that can make us heroic at moments. And heroicism is important. If there's a child over there in danger, you know, we can tap into kind of a heroic mode to help save that child. What I'm trying to say is I think it's become too narrow, become way too masculine identified, way too identified with power. And also, I don't think it's going to work.
Bottom line here, huh?
Yeah, there's no heroic solution when the problems include all aspects of nature and culture. So I kept thinking, well, what it could include all aspects of nature and culture? And that still is connected to human nature, and the old idea of genius, you know, allows that. And because it's a word that people know, I thought maybe I could use that to kind of inspire people to find a genius path in their own life. And then I want to add one other thing. Offer something to young people who are growing up, you know, in a world that's on fire, in a world that's churning culturally and churning in terms of nature too. And the idea that inside the nature of each young person, there could be some gift and quality that could somehow help and also make their own life more anchored and more understandable. And then just one more political thing. The heroic idea partially is what allows the Trumpism to occur. And, of course, it's not just Trump. It's in the Philippines. It's throughout Europe. The idea that there's going to be a heroic savior, or the idea, the thing that allows people to pretend they're the heroic savior, becomes very dangerous. And I think the antidote to it is a great multiplicity of genius awakening that lets people realize we're each here to do something. We don't need some hero to solve it for us.
Well, and I think part of the danger of that heroic savior is always seeking that which is outside of yourself. And so you have this slate to project your own desires and your shadow self on, that's the thing over there. That's the one. I can just put my energy to that and not actually take responsibility for myself, but to, in fact, engage in all of my projections onto this outside figure that's going to save the day, that's going to change things, that's going to do all the work for me.
Yeah. And we see it happening. It's really worldwide now, where the strong man tends to be men.
Yeah.
Strong man is saying, you know, immigration problem, I'll fix that.
Yeah.
Terrorism problem, I'll fix that. And you wish that there was a greater psychological awareness, you know, that when people hear that, they go, oh, yeah, I think that's a little overboard. But it is a time of great stress for everybody, and there's a lot of cultural anxiety, collective anxiety around. And when people get scared and anxious, They often do gravitate towards something that's an exaggeration of certainty. And so you get fundamentalism in politics as well as fundamentalism in religion, because people are desperate and latching on to something. And again, I keep seeing it as multiplicity, the idea that, you know, the many, many ways of imagining the world, just the way nature produces many, many kinds of flowers and trees, it doesn't just stop with one brand. We need to imagine the many, many blossomings of imagination that could, you know, solve things without everybody having to agree on one thing or elevate one person.
Well, that's what I see, and just to talk about political things a little bit, in like our two major parties right now is such an extreme lack of imagination. And you can tell by just what people are gravitating towards that folks are just really tired of that lack of imagination in culture in general. It seems to be but you can, especially with young people, you can see things sort of that I find, and that is sort of encouraging with churning too, that there are things bubbling up.
Well, young people, you know, they can't help it. Young people inhale the atmosphere of the culture. And so now, as you know, because they're trying to expand their lungs along with their imagination and become a full person, or the more growth of themselves, they have to take everything in. And so they're taking in fear and they're taking in random angers. And one reason I picked the word churning is because I was thinking about thinking of the ancient myth of churning the milk ocean, where at certain periods the milk ocean refers to the Milky Way and the whole cosmos. And at certain periods, the whole thing goes into a churning. And when you churn the deep oceans, they find creatures that no one has ever seen that are way down there in the depths. But when the churning goes through the human psyche, it stirs very deep primordial angers and fears and delusions. And so the churning has happened already. It's underway. And so people become subject to illusions and disillusionment and delusions and the surging of angers. And so when I watch the politics of Trump tapping in to these kind of deep, not understood angers and resentments, I don't see it as a simply political thing. I think it's a worldwide cultural thing, because you see it in the Philippines, you see it in Europe. And so it's something we need to understand. And then in mythology, there's always an antidote to the illness. And the idea that for everything that can make you sick, there's a cure somewhere. And so I've been looking for what are the possible cures for living through a period of great turmoil and churning. And I keep coming back to the anchor of the spirit born with each person, the genius that in a mythological sense, the genius brought us to life. You know, it's not our parents that did it, and it's not our ego self that did it. Something wants to live through us. And I find genius to be, you know, a good word, because it doesn't have a gender specificity, and it doesn't have a requirement for heroic strength. It really just means become who you already are and follow that road, and you will not only find some self-satisfaction and inner security, but you will contribute somehow to the world.
I want to remind folks, you are listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning, we are very pleased to have part two of our conversation with storyteller, mythologist, psychologist, Michael Mead. And he will be in town next Wednesday evening, and we'll have a little more detail about that in just a moment. I want to invite your calls at 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. You can call on in. I also want to invite you to like us on Facebook. You can find us, Positively Revolting, on Facebook, and like us there. You can also follow along in the Twitterverse at Positive Revolt. With all of that, Michael, you write humans are mythic by nature. And I would love for you to unpack that a little bit. What do you mean?
Well, myth, the Greek word is mythos. And at one level, it means story. And so in a sense, in the simplest sense, we're story creatures. When we don't have a story, we can become truly lost. And then at another level, each human, each person is a story trying to unfold into the world. We come in with an inner script. It's not predetermined in that old sense that people imagined, you know, that the argument was between freedom and predetermined. You know, both are happening. A person is not empty inside at the beginning. There's this inner script. There's this plot line. There's something trying to pull us to a meaningful destination. So we are creatures of story. Story makes sense to us, and we make most sense when we're living the story of our lives. And, you know, no one can prove these things. Everybody used to know it, but in the times of exaggerated logic and rationalism, people think, you know, they just don't know anymore that we're imbued with story, and this genius that I'm intrigued with is a mythical presence. In other words, you can't, it's not a function of DNA, and it's not something that can be isolated in a microscope. It's like the breath of life in a particular form. And so in mythic terms, I find it really helpful to think that I'm following a plot line. You could call it the gradient of the soul. When I'm near the gradient, I'm more truly myself. And when I'm closer to the old, in India they called it the Dharma, the inner law of the person that allowed them to become themselves and serve something meaningful. When I'm closer to the Dharma, or closer to the gradient line, or closer to the unfolding plot line of my soul, I'm more truly myself. I am closer to my gifts. I am able to heal my wounds better. And I'm able to give something to others in the world around me. And that's the emotional as well as the spiritual fulfillment of a person. When I'm further from the gradient, I feel more isolated, more alone, more subject to random fears and anxieties, and I make more mistakes. And you know those periods when you can't even connect to people properly. You just can't make the connection. Well, one way I think about it is because that when I'm in that state, I've moved too far from the gradient. And so we're mythic in the sense that we need stories to live on, and we are a story trying to unfold ourselves. And in the genius myth in the book, I make the argument between logos and mythos. And logos, we need it. We have to be logical. We have to say, hey, we're going to be on the radio at the same time. We're going to do these things that make sense. But in the ancient world, there was the logical way and the mythological way. And the mythological includes all the things that are not logical, which are a heck of a lot of things, like love, like compassion, like beauty, like vision, like imagination. All those things, back to the tender-minded, all mm-hmm. those things are more necessary now. We've had a lot of logic. We've had a lot of analysis. What we don't have a lot of is true mythological vision, which are needed both by the individual and right now desperately needed by the culture. Polarization happens when there is no imagination and there's no mythic story to bring people together.
Let's go ahead and invite one of our callers to join us this morning. Good morning, Karen. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you very much, Michael, for such a beautiful presentation. I tend to be more pragmatic in my view, so what I was thinking when you were describing the reactions of fear and the seeking of a strong man, I wasn't thinking so much in mythic terms as in terms of trauma and what happens to our perceptions, such as distortions in perceptions and perceiving danger to be present when it's not, and the inability to see the other's point of view and to trust the other, and unconsciously participating in recreating dynamics that resemble the original trauma. And I'm drawing on Michael Lerner, Rabbi Michael Lerner's work. And how do we work with traumatized people? Michael Lerner says we all have elements of social PTSD in us, and how I agree that this spiritual grounding is necessary to help us to navigate these waters of projection and of our own fears arising. And yet I'm not sure how to do this in a massive way, because as we can see, groups of people reinforce one another's delusions, the scapegoating, the blaming the immigrants, blaming African-American people, blaming, we don't have to go into the social dynamics of what has happened in the past. We all know about it. And how can the perspectives that you're offering, how can they break through of mass delusions and mass distortions in perception and help us to heal? I mean, I think compassion, excuse me, I think compassion is a true understanding of cause and effect. And how do we get to that heart-centered trueness with the mythic perspectives that you have? And I'll take the answer off the line. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks, Karen.
Yeah, thank you, Karen.
Yeah, you know, we only have a half an hour to answer that question, Michael.
Yeah, well, it's a sizable question.
It is.
Well stated. And so let's just pick out a few pieces of it. So one of the things that I see going on is, you know, I agree, everybody's traumatized in some way. At least, you know, the abandonment issues that everybody has. It's part of human nature. But part of what's going on now is we have collective trauma. And what I'm calling the churning pushes up to the surface things that everybody thought were buried. You know, so that the ethnic battles that people thought were historical that are back, all the splits between the religions and all that stuff, and now all the gender politics is pushed back up to the surface. So that's part of what I'm calling the churning. And so there's collective forms of trauma, which intensifies the individual's personal form of trauma and leads to what Karen was calling the scapegoating. If we can just blame it on someone, we could be whole for a moment. You know, I worked in prisons a lot for a while, and one of the things I was working with was violent men, and, you know, a lot of them in prison. And in prison, you become more violent.
Sure.
And one of the things I learned was that when someone who has tremendous inner trauma and is boiling and churning and splitting in psychological terms, one man told me, right after I hit someone, for 20 seconds or whatever, I feel whole. As if I could deliver that trauma to someone else, I'm momentarily whole. It doesn't justify anything, but it psychologically explains it. And that's what the scapegoating is, too. If we can just say it's all the Muslims, then the people who identify, you know, as not Muslim suddenly feel whole because, as you were saying earlier, the shadow is put into someone else. So how do you stop that on a collective level? Well, the one of the trauma that was having religions and spiritual groups and rituals that brought everybody together. We all together that is kind of deep and long term. If I find my genius thread up, genius path, my gradient, my way of being authentic and genuine in the world, and if I follow that as best I can, if I follow that as best I can, you know, root in myself, you know, and able to contribute, and maybe if enough people are doing that, maybe if we begin to meet in certain places, we rediscover places, or invent new ways of being together, invent new ways of angling, we eventually have the antidote, eventually, to this collective trauma that's going to kill the dividing of your body. This is difficult stuff, and I don't know difficult stuff how to... I don't think there's any single thing that's going to work.
That would be the hero myth, wouldn't it?
It would be. And it's what science claims. It's what technology claims. It's what all of the Western white culture has always claimed with the Enlightenment and everything. And it has brought us to where we are. So, strangely, I think it involves a kind of trust in the unseen, so that the unseen in myself has to become visible, and unseen things in the world have to become more visible. There's something bigger than us. That's the other kind of reduction of the hero myth. It isn't up to us to save the thing. You know, they're digging. So you think in terms of what's the churning. So in the churning, a lot of things collapse and other things surface. And so they're literally right now digging down into the depths of the rock below the ocean in off of Yucatan, where the asteroid hit however many years ago that destroyed 75% of life on the Earth. And so they're drilling down into it, I don't know, 12 miles deep into the Earth, in order to get cores of that rock mineral out, in order to understand what happened when almost all of life on Earth was destroyed, when there was a intense period of overheating followed by a glacial age. How did life survive? They want to study that trauma deep down in the Earth that has been recorded in the rocks down there in order to understand how that survival occurred. So that they're doing literally what I'm saying we need to do mythically. Dig down below our trauma. Dig down below the collective sense of history. Dig down, is there something down there or not? Modern ideas of an accidental universe say there's nothing down there. Inside, we're empty. Mythology basically says deep down there is the core of the deep self that is able to renew and revive and restore itself. And if we can touch that individually, we may eventually figure out how to touch it collectively.
I like the physicist Frank Wilczek says, you can recognize a deep truth by the feature that its opposite is also a deep truth.
Yeah, that's the problem. There we are. Right?
Yeah. Well,
everything that's deeply true has an opposite
right.
that's also deeply true.
Right. And that is seems to be a real hard one for us humans to wrap our little minds around.
So, you know, I love ancient stuff because it's very old and it's still around.
Right.
Yeah, right. Must be something to it, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So Native Americans, remember, the Native people who were here before most of us, even though we have our own indigenous self that can connect to their indigenous nature, they literally were here. And we walk, in a sense, our feet are walking in the stories that they held. And so one of the great ideas, I think, in Native tradition, were in certain tribes, they would have not a defense department that is truly a war department. They would have a war chief. They would have the chief who leads everybody's kind of martial energy and protects when protection is possible and attacks when that's necessary. But they also had a peace chief. And so here were your two divisions, the tender, and the tough.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing was, they said, these two are equal, except for the fact that the peace chief is slightly more important and slightly more powerful. So what they were trying to say is when it comes to human culture and when it comes to life on Earth itself, everything is divided into night and day. Everything is divided into left and right, up and down. We to be born, to live on Earth, to become a living entity means to be divided. Our bodies are left and right. We have lungs on either side and all that kind of stuff. But everything is slightly tipped towards enhancing life. And so in the crucial moment, the peace chief could pull rank on the war chief because the peace chief represented life continuing. And that is, and so their understanding was the whole of the, what we call the cosmos or the whole universe is tipped slightly towards continuing with life. So I'm saying we're living in a period now where we have to understand that we have to trust that it's tipped that way. And then secondly, in order to join ongoing creation, to be agents of creation, we have to tip ourselves that way, realize that, yes, I'm a person who has messed up in this way, and I've made mistakes, I've hurt people, or I'm carrying a lot of trauma. But down below the trauma is that element that allows life to continue, and I think we have to learn that element more, and I'm giving that element the old name of our genius nature, because by calling it genius, it shows that it's gifted, and it also implies there's something to do with it. There's a destination to take it to. There's a calling.
You are listening to KABU. It's your community radio station. We are talking with Michael Mead this morning. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
This is Positively Revolting. And Michael will be in town next Wednesday, May 18th at 7 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church. There are tickets still available, and people can find out more information about that by going to Michael's website, which is mosaicvoices.org. Michael, can you tell us a little bit more about what you're going to be doing in Portland next Wednesday?
Well, I'm going to be happy to be back in Portland. I really love being in Portland, and there's usually, what's making me think of is this. So everybody's hungry now, near as I can tell. Everybody's hungry for an answer, even the people that are lining up, you know, for a Trump rally. They're really hungry for something that says, you know, is it okay? Can I be okay? Is there anything that can unify us? And so I encounter it all over the place, with the wealthy as well as those, you know, the have-nots. I don't care about that 1%, what they think they are. They're empty inside. I know because I've worked with their children.
I mean that in an ironic way, yeah.
In the book, I tell a story of a retreat in the desert with what I call at-risk rich kids. And what I found out what they were suffering from the most was the sense that they were empty inside, and all they had was the program that their family wanted them to follow and the promise that they would be wealthy if they did it, when they would really, you know, impoverished on the inside. So, roundabout way of saying... One thing I love about Portland is people come with their hunger kind of pronounced, and a kind of feeling that we're going to find something that satisfies us on this occasion. That's something I've experienced when I go to Portland. So, but what I will be doing is taking the stories from the book and laying out some stories, and then using it. You know, each occasion is completely different. What I'm trying to do is be awake to vertical imagination while I'm presenting. And then the idea is for everybody to feel our way into a space where we each get something to take home. Another idea about mythology is everybody is fed by mythology in the way that they need to be fed. So a story follows a certain arc and projection, but each person sees and feels from it what they need. That's the beauty of myth to me. So I'll be trying to lay out the story, and then we'll be in a conversation, too, about what we're each seeing and what we're each feeling. And then we'll have some songs and things so we can find a harmony, because sometimes that's the only way you can find harmony is through actual songs. And so it's a storytelling thing. It's a mythological thing. And then it's also a community ritual.
And always a great time.
All things rolled into one. Let's go ahead and talk to Camilo. Good morning, Camilo.
Good morning. I have a question, and it's a kind of a challenge for Michael, because he's interested in ancient ideas, and there is an ancient idea that has been around for 2,600 years, which pretty much encompasses all of Michael's synthesis, but with somewhat slightly different language, and that is the Dharma of Buddhism. And rather than the notion of genius, which I see as having a somewhat exclusive quality, the idea is that everyone possesses basic goodness. And indeed, in order to access basic one's basic goodness, one must have compassion for oneself, and use that to discover compassion in the other. And rather than think about mythology, think about truth and the truth of the Dharma. And the question and challenge is, I'm sure Michael is aware of this tradition and philosophy, and why doesn't he simply explore that and expose the values and realities of the Dharma rather than think up a new synthesis?
Okay, thank you for your question.
Thank you, Camilo. Good challenge. So in the book, I mention that one of the interpretations of Dharma is the law, L-A-W, the law inside one's soul, that one way to understand Dharma is a person is inclined a certain way. Some people are here with more of a devotional soul, and so they would take that kind of a path. Others have more of a hunger for knowledge, and they would be on the path of jnana, it used to be called, the divine path of knowledge. So actually what I'm doing is saying genius is a Western word, although it's probably North African to begin with, but it's known in the West. And because genius is so multiple, each person, nature only makes originals. Each person is an original making of nature that has its inner Dharma, has its inner genius. I think that's the critical point right now. And so I'm trying to touch the root of Buddhism as well, and Hinduism for that matter, and tribal imagination for that matter. So call it Dharma, call it genius, call it the divine companion of the soul, call it the muses, call it anything you want. When you get to it, all of those things become possible. And so two things about, I would say, just to respond to the challenge. Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. Buddha, you could say, was following his own genius, and Buddhism was the result. So to me, if a person is going to follow Buddha, then at some point they have to step out of the teachings as they're understood and onto the pathless path. Buddha was on a path, making a path by walking on it. So to really follow Buddha would be to find one's own pathless path. And I'm saying your pathless path is also your genius path. And so the other thing is that, as someone said earlier, maybe Ani said that, anything that is deeply true, its opposite is also true. And so Buddhism holds a truth, but it doesn't hold all the truth. Let me put it another way. Mythologically, in the center of everything is the living tree of life. In the story of Buddha, that becomes the Bodhi tree. In the story of Native Americans, it becomes the Sundance tree. Everyone has some connection to the tree of life. When you're just beginning the road, trying to find your way to the tree of life at the center, when you're on the outside of the circle of that and you're just trying to go into the deep middle, when you look in other directions, you see other people at the outside of the circle trying to make their way into the middle, and everybody thinks their ways are all so different because we're on the outside of the circle. The closer a person gets to the center, to the tree at the center, the Bodhi tree, the Sundance tree, the Celtic tree of life, in the middle of, I forget what you call it, but in the middle of the Jewish tradition, you have the menorah, you have the tree there as well, even the Christian tradition. The closer you get to it, the more everybody begins to see the Buddha nature in each other, the more everybody begins to see the kind of same kind of imagination or the same kind of devotion and the same kind of compassion. And so mythologically speaking, all of the truths become true when you get to the middle. And by the way, The word tree and the word truth come from the same root. And so I cannot take on the cloak of Buddhism. I can't do it because of my connection to mythology, because I will be pulled by a story into an area of what would be called Hinduism, because I'm being pulled by Shiva at the moment, and I'm seeing the truth of that Shiva view of life, and so on. So at least for me personally, my kind of connection to mythology forces me to see truths on all the paths, and so I don't know if that helps.
Well, but I think you answered that.
Oh, okay.
I think you did.
Yeah.
I want to bring in our next caller, who is our good friend Todd Davies, who is a fellow storyteller, Michael. So I will and needs to turn her radio down, I think.
Oop. Hey, guys.
Hi, Todd.
How are you this morning?
Very good, thank you.
I got to turn you down, yeah. Oh, man, that's confusing. Oh, this has been great. Thank you so much for turning me on to this, Lynn. Michael, I gave a little talk yesterday down here in Southern Oregon about the importance of story, and we talked about a lot of these things, and there were a lot of your fans in the There are a lot of your fans in the group who I hope are listening this morning because I told them that you were going to be on. So I'm loving especially the idea, which I totally believe, which is that every individual has a genius, which the culture desperately needs right now and needs to bring out their own story. And one of the things I'd love to hear you comment on is the role of drugs in repressing that genius, or, you know, expressing it if you think so, but especially what I'm interested in is the legal drugs, which seem to have gone out of control, especially for kids, and especially for upper middle class kids, antidepressants, you know, ADD drugs, things like that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, thank you, and good to hear a fellow storyteller. Well, it's one of the stories we're living now. And so the way I tracked that one down, Western culture picked up the idea of tabula rasa, the idea of a blank slate, and that everybody's born as a blank slate. And then we become the result of the DNA of our parents and the impressions made on us by our family and our culture. And so that leaves out this idea of the inner dharma, the inner genius, the kind of seeded soul. And so there's all kinds of intricacies and problems, including if the mother is taking certain kind of drugs during the period of pregnancy and even during the time of birth, that gets right into the body of the one being born, who is at the most rapid period of growth in their life, and it doesn't take much of getting a little bit of a drug in there to affect the child. So there's things like that going on. But mythologically and psychologically, what I've become really intrigued with is the idea that most people now think they're empty inside. Mm. And so when I'm working with street kids and gang kids and all, they're all using drugs, and they're all trying to get a feeling from the outside that they could get on the inside, but they think they have taken this idea on that inside they are at best bad and at worst completely empty. And so they're feeling this emptiness inside and hoping to bring in a substance that gives them a momentary feeling of being substantial. Or, as we were talking about earlier, they're trying to alleviate a traumatic pain that they think they can't deal with. And so in working with young people in those kind of conditions, of which I'm sorry to say there's many, 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 I was really surprised at how effective it was if I could say, you know, you're a genius. You know you have a genius in there. Now, especially if I could spend time with them, I could see hints of what their genius might be. I'll give an example. I'm working in Chicago with these street gangs. We're trying to do truth work. And I get involved with this one particular gang because it's one of the few gangs that had both African-American and Latino kids in it. And the leader of the gang is a big, really tough, really dangerous guy. And he's brilliant. he has language that's almost Shakespearean. And I'm watching how he does things. And I say that to him one day. I say, you know, you're a strong guy and you're tough, but I don't think that's who you really are. I say, you're more about language. And I don't want to curse on the air too much.
Please.
He responded with a string of curses. And I said, see that? I said, you curse better than most people I know. And he said, what? And I said, look, you got this thing with your language. And I don't know if you understand that could save your life more than the gun you're packing. And I didn't get much of a reaction at that point. But the next time I went back, he wanted to talk about that and so on. So let's just say I'm still in touch with him. That's probably 15 years ago, maybe 18 years ago. He's running a mentoring program now, and he's a storyteller. He went back to school, and he realized that's true, that what it really, his essence is about language and words, and it was the trauma he was in and all kinds of abandonments he had suffered that caused him to be both involved with drugs and involved with violence. So this idea that I'm intrigued with his genius is something that I found of necessity working with people severely at risk and on the edge.
Oh, thank you for that. I'm going to let you guys move on to another caller.
Thank you so much, Todd.
Bye.
And actually, that is a place where I want to go as we are at the end of show. When we have, each of us, as we grow in our Western society, it seems like there are so many things that tap down, that take us away, that take our attentions away, that even shame us for our genius. So that we distance ourselves, we grow distant from ourselves, we grow alienated through the traumas, through public schooling, through the shame of if we actually do listen and are in touch with our inner genius, that thing that makes us unique and special. By the time we get to middle school, that is a source of great shame because we're not supposed to be different and special, except in all the same way that we're all different and special. And so as we move through our lives in this trauma, and as the world is churning and calling us to be our geniuses, our genius selves, what are some of the stories? What are some of the paths back? How do we walk the labyrinth back to our inner genius? How do we uncover this?
You have 5 minutes.
We're getting all the big questions today.
You know, I figure it's part two, right, Michael?
You got 5 minutes, Michael.
I guess this happens in part two, I guess. I didn't know part two was so hard.
Yeah, really?
Wait till you get to part three. You're gonna...
So it's interesting, though, because I call it the second adventure of life. First adventure is get a life, you know, get your feet on the ground, try to figure out how to survive. Second adventure is try to figure out who am I really? And so here's the problem with this. It's different for each person. Mm. One reason I love this approach is there's no real rules. I mean, the only thing I'm trying to say is there is something there. You know, that's a given. But what it is that makes a person unique and how a person finds it is also unique. So just a couple of hints. The old saying that... adversity reveals genius, and comfort hides it. So in times of adversity, we're actually closer to our genius. So this goes against everything we've been taught, like, you know, feel good, or don't go there because it feels bad, or it's scary. And genius is in those places that could be scary if there wasn't genius there. So this is a difficult thing to say at the ending, but... when I'm talking about genius, I know that genius is next to the wounds. So it's a double-sided thing. A person has to find the genius and heal the wounds. So you can go at it the other way around. If I go near my wounds, I'm actually near the genius. So sometimes the easiest way to find one's genius is to go where the wounds are the deepest. Carl Jung said that. Genius hides behind the wound. That's what he said. So if I go, if someone is older and they want to look back over their life and see the places where they felt most at risk or most rejected or something, they will find themselves closer to their genius when they look at that. And sometimes what I'm calling genius, the uniqueness of the self, is actually what saves us during those times, because those of us who have survived have actually lived through something. You know, I have friends that died very young, and I was right next to them. And there's something inside us that wants us to live, and it, so when we go near the wounds, we can find the genius. Now, that's challenging, but I think that may be true for most people. If someone has an extraordinary talent, they're a child prodigy, everybody sees their genius. Their problem becomes, how do you live with it?
Right.
For the rest of us, it often becomes, if we really examine our life, we'll see that it has been near us at certain times. And so the problem with it is that it is unique for each person. The path is unique. And so there, I can't really name a way to go there. But when you're working with people, you can find it. I want to go back to the idea we are the carriers of story, and we are a story trying to unfold. I know there's a kind of popular idea now, leave your past behind and get out of that story. I would say the past is never left behind. It travels with us, just the way that thing happening down in the rocks that they're trying to find out what caused that big destruction, you know, 66 million years ago. Everything travels with us. So turn into one story and get down to the deep rock bed of that story, which is going to be both things that are hard to deal with and then the hidden gold, the hidden gems, the hidden jewels that are right down there deep in the story. So I guess I'm trying to say, inhabit one's own story more fully. And yes, there will be woundedness, but there will also be the genius, the golden self waiting to be discovered.
Inhabiting one's own story more fully. Thank you, Michael Mead, for joining us again here on Positively Revolting on KBOO Community Radio in Portland. You're going to be in Portland next Wednesday night, May 18th, 7 o'clock at the First Unitarian Church. There are tickets still available, and you, dear listeners, can find out more about that at mosaicvoices.org.
Thank you so much for being with us, Michael. We'll see you Wednesday night.
All right. Thank both of you.
You're so very welcome.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And with that, we come to a close of another Positively Revolting morning. We hope that you too continue to positively revolt in your life. And congratulations, Teresa, on this, your time of freedom.
Every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the United States premiere of Liza, 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 produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. Join Liza Minnelli at three different stages of her life, often all on stage at the same time, with plenty of songs, backstories about the iconic and troubled daughter of Judy Garland, with a bit of dancing and prancing and much humor among the frightening tales of drink, drug abuse, broken legs, strokes, and hip replacements. Again, that's Liza, 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 May 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Okay. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Friends of Noise launch party on Sunday, May 22nd at 5:30 at Los Prados Event Hall in St. John's. Friends of Noise is a new Portland-based nonprofit sponsoring all-ages shows while working towards a brick-and-mortar space for youth to learn about the music industry. The kickoff event will feature performances by the Doo Doo Funk All-Stars, Neo Geo, Drex Porter, and Gem Dynasty. Again, that's the Friends of Noise all-ages launch party, Sunday, May 22nd, with doors opening at 5:30 p.m., the show starting at 6:30 p.m., at Los Prados Event Hall, 10105 North Lombard Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. Coming up on Economic Update, host Richard Wolf interviews reporter Bob Henley about false economic recovery, dissolving society, and real journalism. That's followed at 10 with Aircast Skadia with Chris Andre, and rounding out the hour with Flashpoints, focusing on Haiti with senior producer Kevin Pina and guests, including political analyst France Jerome. At 11 on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yeaman interviews Brian Christian, co-author of the new book Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. Also speaking with Shauna Scott about the upcoming Open Source Bridge Conference. And thanks, KBOO members, for helping us with our recent successful membership drive. We could not do it without you.